Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, Anna.
If country borders and grids can fascinate you, and state names intrigue you, if atlases, globes, city plans, subway maps, and of course, world maps are your thing, if you can name the capital city of Namibia, and if you get giddy about flags, you are in the right place. This is Map Corner, a podcast about the love of maps brought to you by Royfield Brown and Claire Asprey. Now, on with the show.
Hello and welcome to Map Corner. I'm Royfield Brown, who is in the UK. Say where, it says here. I'm in Birmingham and I've completely neglected to do my coordinates. If you're bothered, you can be fussed. You can go on to a search engine of your choice, type in what are the coordinates of Birmingham, and it will tell you. But it's somewhat in the kind of in the middle of England. But with me is the wonderful, luminous, she look lovely today. If you're watching on Zoom, she's radiant. It's Claire Asprey. Claire, I say every month, where are you today?
And every month I say I'm at 52.1 degrees north and 0.5 degrees east, and I'm in Bedfordshire in the UK.
Map Corner is a podcast dedicated to the love of maps and to all things cartophilic, which is not actually a word, but it should be. So if Peters is your projection, you're in the right place.
And in this episode, we are delighted to welcome back international social media map supremo and friend of the show, Simon Quistemacher.
Thanks for having me again.
Listen, we can't keep you off, right? By popular demand. And also, I believe you have very good reason to be with us today, which you'll tell us all about in a little bit. We have an audio postcard from our Nick Rowworth, who I've just discovered, just before we start the show, is a yoga teacher. This man, I reckon he's also part-time works for the CIA or something. You know, Nick does everything. Now, folks, don't forget to review us on Apple iTunes, because I should give it its proper title, Apple Podcasts. It hasn't been called iTunes for podcasts for quite some time, because the more reviews we get, it means that we got those podcast charts and it means that more people get to know about the podcast. So please give us a review. That would be awesome.
Again, we're joined by some of our Map Corner listeners, and it's great that we're doing a slightly different time slot this time. So we're able to be joined by our Antipodean listeners. So if you want to join in Zoom with our next recording, then get into the Facebook group and you'll see the links posted there. Or if you're not on Facebook and you want to know the links, then just drop us a line via the website or on Twitter.
We record every first Sunday of the month. Generally, it's at 6 p.m. UK time, which is 1 p.m. Eastern, which is 10 a.m. Pacific. But as Claire said, because we have the wonderful, the important, the now published in book form, Simon Quistemacher with us, and he's in Oz, we had to move the slot. Simon, welcome back to the show. How have things been in the last, 2+ years since you very first came on?
Yeah, I think obviously a tiny bit of a global pandemic happened. Like everyone else, very little travel. You get to know, since I've been long living in Melbourne, in Australia, which has won the title of the most locked down city in the world. So no other city has been in a lockdown for longer than we guys here. So that's a nice little, prize to take home. Yeah, indeed. We put this on the town signs and postcards, I guess.
You'd have to take it home. You can't go anywhere else.
That's right. And so we really got to get to know our local neighborhood really well. But that said, like the whole world, we, of course, switched to Zoom and I did lots of presentations on my demographic research stuff online all the time, which is good fun. And by now that Australia is finally open again and I have work, travel things lined up, I'm a bit freaked out by the idea of leaving the house for work. But it's now back on the cards.
Are you kind of freaked out about leaving the house because there's a young Kirsten Macca now?
I guess that's the sad part about it. Is usually when I do a presentation, it really takes an hour if I do an hour's worth of presentation. But now I have to travel throughout the country for an hour's worth of presentation. And so I miss time with my 1.5-year-old, which is just a shame because in the whole working from home environment, you can completely maximize family time. Since I don't commute, I get to chat with a little fella a lot, which is good fun. And for example, our company completely killed the office. That's always, people discuss in Australia an awful lot, when should people go back to the office? We don't. We said we'll meet once a month in a cafe. that's our policy, which we can do as a five-headed global powerhouse of demographic research.
And I hope you're starting young Kirsten Macca on maps at a very early age. Forget letters, maps. Starting with maps, Simon, please tell us that you start as you mean to go on with raising your little son.
I'm trying to see. I think it's downstairs. I did, of course, buy a book called Map Projections for Babies. That was...
I could that one on the show.
Yeah, I could resist. I saw it online and I had to buy it right away. And silly me, I only bought one copy. So he has the copy now.
And you've got your own book now, which I am lucky to have a copy of. And it's a very beautiful thing itself. It's called Random Maps, the World in Over 100 Unusual Maps. And I mean, you are posting interesting maps multiple times a day. So my first question is, how on earth did you whittle it down to the ones that you picked for the book?
Yeah, so for the last 5 years, I've been posting about 7 or 8 maps per day. You can do the maths, never missed a day. That's many, many thousands of maps. I can't count that much. And so that was quite the task to pick the favorites. At first, I went through this and went like, okay, what were my favorite maps? And then you realize, okay, so I did really enjoy a lot of animated stuff, which of course isn't suited for a book. And then some of the maps, it's a bit tricky to get a copyright for. And then some of the maps were a bit too obscene to be put into a book. So there are a couple of easy ways to weed out. And then it's a matter of getting the rights. And so I did collect, I think, about 300 maps were in the pre-selection. And then we worked with the publisher just asking all the nice cartographers for the rights. And we then... picked the top 110 or thereabouts for the book. And so it was nice to get a bit of an insight into the wonderful world of book publishing and just really enjoyed the journey. It's all on top of the full family and work schedule. So it was an additional challenge, but it was good fun. And the book was originally published in German. And in Germany, if you want to do anything and make it sound cool, you give it an English name. So the German version was called Mad Maps, why ever. Also, authors don't tend to pick the headlines in newspapers or the titles of books, unless they're really famous, which I'm not. And then, of course, I think we ran through 5 or 6 titles that were all copyrighted already for the English version. And then we picked random maps after... We kind of said, what do you actually do? And I said, I just select random maps simply based on the fact that I find them fascinating and interesting. And I don't follow any political agenda or any kind of specific corner that I go into with the maps that I share online. I just want to find them interesting. And I want to go like, huh, isn't that interesting? That's kind of what I do. And it is very random and selective and a bit quirky. And yeah, so I'm actually quite happy with the title, even though it might seem a bit random, so to speak.
No, Simon, right. And this is a family podcast, right. But I'm quite interested in the obscene maps. Just give us just a broad brushstrokes of the type of naughty
maps. Exactly. So there are lots of maps that just talk about swear words across the world. And so we'd say, yeah, let's keep this safe and family friendly. I'm, of course, not. There are a couple of bizarre. There were more charts rather than maps that just showed whenever there is whenever there's a Facebook outage in the world, the porn usage goes up. So it's really Facebook might be annoying for all kind of things, but it keeps you from looking at porn. So it's stuff like this that's just funny, quirky, bizarre insights. I don't think they're good for anything. I don't think they really make you understand the deep human soul of humanity, but it's just a bit of fun.
Gotcha. And actually, I really like how you got to go a bit map adjacent when you do retweet and reshare quite a lot of things that are kind of infographics or charts, specifically maps. So have you got a book coming out about infographics and charts, or is that back on the back burner?
I do work on another book. We're all friends here. On a children's book. Not about map projections, but there is a children's mappy book coming that I'm involved in. So that's fun. Just a fun little side project once again. So that is happening in the background. That'll still be a year away, I guess. But then we can have the kids version of this podcast again.
So you've been like a bit of a magpie on social media for years. That's the reason why you were our very first guest, because you're known on Twitter and on Facebook for linking to great and interesting maps. Was it always your idea actually to eventually publish a book, or is this something which has come along as a great idea as your reputation has been burnished online?
I didn't think of a book. Just a publisher called me and said, do you want to do a book? And the reason, and it was the second publisher that asked, where I said yes. The first was like, it's too much work. I don't think this, because there isn't too much money in publishing. So you don't do this for the money, to be quite frank. And so the first publisher I said no to, but the second publisher was from my hometown of Munich. So I kind of thought that's nice. You see, this is absolutely not a financial or even an intellectual decision to do this. I just kind of thought the idea is nice that when I'm in Munich visiting my parents, that I can go visit my publisher. I kind of thought that it was a nice thing to have.
Run us through maybe like three maps which you think kind of are emblematic of the book, you know, in terms of kind of their range, what they talk about, etc. And this is this favorite bit of Map Corner for me, because I always love people on an audio podcast talking about something which is inherently
talking about a visual. The two maps that immediately come to mind. The first one is a 1914 map of London, or of the whole world, and it shows the travel time from London to all over the world, which I immensely enjoyed. And you just see that, you know, within 5 days, you reach almost every corner of Europe.
Listen up, guys. 5 days. You might come up in the quiz.
Exactly. Yeah, so that is 100 odd years ago. 5 days got you into most parts of Europe. So that's somewhat interesting. If you then go from London to Australia, it's definitely over 40 days. So that's just the order of magnitude that you travel then. And then a company called Rome to Rio, who are also based in Melbourne, or of all places where I'm based, they did a updated version of this for 2016, which in a very cute way, reimagined the vintage style of the map, and then updated it with today's travel times. And of course, most travel times here rely on super fast rail connections, if it's more locally, and on airplanes that weren't around in 1914. And all of a sudden, you see that the most unreachable corners of the globe can be reached within 36 hours. So within less than 2 days, you can be teleporting yourself, if you will, to anywhere in the world. And I think this is just such a wonderful way of remembering how the world has changed just for the better. If I am traveling from Australia to my parents in Germany, I'm very glad that I can do this in under 40 hours rather than in just under 40 days. So that would be the first map that comes to mind, since I really, really enjoyed this. And it's just a cute way of modern cartographers looking at the at an old map through a new lens. That is rather original. So I do really like that. I then think I would have also to mention a map about wolves that's in there. It just shows the GPS tracked data of, I think, 9 wolves in a national park. And the beautiful thing is that they don't intersect at all. Wolves really respect each other's territories. And I never, you hear these kind of things and you don't know what that means. I don't know stuff about wolves. And so you see this in a map, you go, that's actually what territories mean. They sniff out each other's territory and they respect it. I think that's absolutely fascinating. And if you know my my tweets, you know that I'm absolutely obsessed with GPS tracked animals. It's just such a beautiful thing that we have these kind of data sets. Before, a couple of less than 100 years or more, just probably 200 years ago, you didn't even know that animals, that birds migrated. It's that old famous story where there were stories just floating around that birds over winter, they transform into other animals. Or they were just hiding somewhere out of plain sight. And it was just unsure what happened. And then more and more people discovered what they called Pfeilstörche, arrow storks. So these were storks that traveled from Europe down to Africa. And some of them were shot with arrows and they just survived. So they just had an arrow stuck in them. And when the Europeans then discovered those animals and they actually tested and had, you know, the wise professors analyzed the arrows. They understood that these were African arrows. And that really helped scientists to understand bird migration was a thing. I think that's just a cute, wonderful story that is now we can GPS tag the smallest of birds and we can see the exact migration behavior. It's easy. It's wonderful. It's good fun to look at. There are wonderful websites that allow you to look at bird migrations. It's great. But before that, when speculation rules supreme, you come up with weird sounding narratives to fill the gaps. But that's what we do. When we don't know what's happening, we fill the gaps with whatever we come up with. And it sounds ridiculous from the standpoint of knowledge. And, you know, to draw the arc back to modern day times, we see this in a pandemic where there's so much hearsay about things and the unknown is always filled. The unknown is never left empty. We don't leave empty spaces. We try to fill it, and that creates error. It would be much more honest to fill those spaces with a big sign that says the unknown, which brings me to the third map, Royfield, that I would like to mention. It is a map that shows, so it's an atlas from, I think, memory 1830 or thereabouts. So 200 years old, and it shows how much Europeans knew about the world at different stages. There are about 60 or pages or thereabouts. It's crazy big, and you can look at it online for free on the Ramsey Map Center. And the map shows this part of Europe that was and the Middle East that was known to the locals at the time, and the rest of the world is clouded in some sort of like the fog of war style drawing. It looks marvelous, and I'm amazed by this because the cartographer was bold enough to show the unknown, to actually emphasize the unknown in each of those maps. And it gives you a great sense of, okay, there was a limited worldview at the time, but whatever is visible on the map, that is the whole world. for them. Therefore, America was the new world when it was finally discovered from a European perspective. And I find that just fascinating to see how much your worldview, quite literally, must have shifted once you are being told that your map needs to be updated, that you actually need to draw not a small, tiny island somewhere, but you throw a whole new continent into the mix. I find this endlessly wonderful to think about.
There's one of the books which really stayed with me in my kind of like mid and late childhood is a thing called Muir's Historical Atlas. And it's the geopolitical changing of borders all throughout human history.
Yeah.
And one of the little things which goes alongside all the political maps is actually our understanding of what the world looked like at that time. Obviously, from a Eurocentric point of view. So you got like Ptolemy's map of Europe, yeah. Which is in some bits is surprisingly accurate. Like Italy looks like Italy. You know, Spain looks like Spain or you know, the Iberian Peninsula, I should say. And then in the Middle Ages, and it just atomizes and it's weird and people make things up. And then from like the 1500s, it gets more accurate again and again. And I as a little kid, I used to go backwards and forwards looking at those sections of that book. However, right now, Simon, we're on a strict schedule today, right? Because we've very obviously you take pride of place, sir, as being our very first map corner interviewee, but we have somebody else at 6 o'clock. And there's and so basically what it means is, right, I'm running this on rails today. And this is an apt little metaphor for me to say Nick Rowworth. Now, Nick Rowworth did such an epic audio postcard that we had to divide it into two. And here we have part deux of Nick Rowworth's wonderful audio postcard. But if you are watching on Zoom, of course, it's a video postcard about his hometown of Bookham.
Although I was born in Manchester, at age 7, I moved to Bookham in the Surrey Stockbroker Belt. Expansion, which now goes all the way to the Common, stopped after it was declared Green Belt. So all later developments were made from either developing big houses or infilling in the large gardens they had. The house I grew up in was one of three houses built in the garden of the neighbours. Although these days, you would probably fit about 20 into this space. And his garden was so big at the time that his deeds still have in them that he's not allowed to hold a funfair in it. And our back garden had really nice grass. It was a part of the tennis court of the house. It also had nut trees and fruit trees. These days, the most notable part of the village is at the crossroads, as it has a square about. And yes, this does have its own Facebook page. This is a raised area of block paving at which nobody has a right of way. And when they get to it, nobody knows what to do with. My motto is always, he who hesitates is lost. Just wait and take your chance there. The village has 5 pubs. Would have had more, but Mrs. Christie, a rich woman who owned a lot of Bookham, was into temperance and kept buying them up and closing them down. In fact, there would have been one at the end of my road called the Fox and Grapes, but she bought that and closed it down, and this became the Little Bookham Village Hall when she donated it to the community. She also built some temperance hotels with large tea rooms. One of these, the Merrylands Hotel, was opposite the station, and she would pay for the poor of the East End of London to come by down by train and have tea there. One of Jane Austen's cousins, the Cooks, was a rector at the church, so she visited Bookham quite often and wrote some of her books here. If you look at her letters, though, it sounds like she didn't like visiting her cousins very much. And apparently one of the servants was allegedly named Elizabeth Bennet. So I think a lot of the characters and settings may be based in Bookham. If you're ever in the area, it's worth a visit to the church, to wander over the common, or just wonder at the stupidity of putting a square about at the crossroads. Failing that, you could always just look at it on a map. And whatever, I live wherever I go, Bookham will always be my home.
There you go. Nick Roworth, take a bow, sir. Epic.
Lovely.
Well done, sir. Well done, sir. I've never heard of a square about before, Nick.
I think it's one of the only ones.
And what was the reason for the square about? What is it supposed to do? Do we know?
I have no idea. I think it's the idea is to slow traffic down. I mean, it used to be because the road that goes across is the lower road, which is one of the major roads. That's the sort of main road. But I think it's just to stop traffic whizzing along and just through. But as I say, people get there, they have no clue what to do there. No one has a right of way. And if you're on your bike, the thing gets wet and you slide off. It's just a total nightmare. And people often put things like on April Fool's Day, they'll put double yellow lines around it to say, you know, you can't park on it anymore. So.
Well, I've learned something by editing your wonderful audio postcard, sir, that there is even a thing called a square about. That news to me. But as a traffic calming measure, it's rather successful. Yeah, and even in the little video, you saw the car go there and kind of pause, not knowing exactly what to do. So thank you. And of course, Nick won the opportunity to show us his hometown, his home village, because he won the quiz. And the quiz will be coming up later. And what we do is whenever you win the quiz, you have the opportunity, the accolade, the props to be the person who does the audio postcard on the next month's map corner. But we need to go back to you, Mr. Kirsten Macker, because you're here illuminating us with your presence, but also with your book. New York Times bestseller 2022, Random Maps. What do you reckon?
I don't think so. I think this is it's a beautiful gift. So I'm hoping that, you know, it will make its way to the shops before Christmas. And it's a nice gift to give to, you know, people that really just enjoy a bit of a random insight into a map. It doesn't need to be read as a whole, which helps, you know, if you live in a rowdy, raucous household. It's good to just, you know, look at a map or two here and there and don't, I write a little text for each map, but it's really just to give a tiny bit of context. I think you can just do this whole book visually if you wanted to.
Fantastic. And also what I did forget to say, good people, is now is the time for you. If your name is Andrew Cooper, Brett Watkins, Nick Roworth, or Sarah Spilsbury, to unmute yourself, unburden yourself, unshackle yourself from silence, and actually throw a question at Mr. Kirsten Macker. And maybe what you want to do is ask him for a signed copy of his book for Christmas. That'd be something that'll be worth a lot of money sometime soon. But in the back channel, in the chat, Nick Roworth has said, the more Christmas present sorted, right? And then Brett has also agreed. He says, yes, mine too. So there you go. Here's two sales of your book. So, you know, when you get a book published and your name's on it, and I applaud your honesty of saying, you know, when I go home to Munich, I want to say to mom and dad, I just got to nip out and meet my publisher. Because it's not an everyday kind of conversation. Are you like nervously looking at how the book is kind of doing and stuff? Do you just go, oh my goodness, you know, we've done another 100 sales in Germany. That's good. That's bad. You know, are you sweating? I don't know. How does it work?
No. So with the German version, I just get an update every half a year of how many copies are being sold, and then they send a little check, and that's all nice. And it's a nice.
Checks?
Oh, absolutely not. Figuratively speaking, I get a super cool email zoomed to me. So that's all very easy. But I guess the most interesting fact that I learned about maps in the process is that my publisher said, usually we print our books in China. They just produce the cheapest printing. So most printing these days is done in China, unless books mention Tiananmen Square or unless you have a quote of the Dalai Lama in there, you talk about Tibet, then China isn't really keen on publishing those books. They really put pressure on the printers over there to not publish those books. Ah, yeah, and of course, any book with a map in it will not be printed in China, because they insist that the map meets certain aesthetic geopolitical guidelines, and that is not a given in my book, so to speak. So therefore, this book was printed in Dubai. This is the, you know, it's probably not as cheap, I guess, than printing in China, but that's what you do when you are at the mercy of a all-powerful government in China.
Wow, that's interesting.
The one thing which we've never really talked about on Map Corner is the perception of the world mapping-wise from other countries, from the perspective of other countries. You know, because we all know that the United Kingdom is the center of the world. Everybody knows that. Greenwich Meridian, right? So, exactly. You know, you open up an atlas, if you're British, and the first thing you'll see is Britain, and then it's Greenwich Meridian, and then everything else spreads out from that. Yeah. You know, that's wild countries like Australia you go to. You know, you're going to open up an atlas. It's going to start with Australia. What kind of craziness is that?
There's actually a really beautiful map in the book, which is the world from the dolphin's point of view, which is very ocean-centric and also south at the top. And, you know, it is just, I really love it because, I mean, apart from the fact it's very pretty because it's a lovely colour, but it does force you to think about the world in a completely different way. And I think that's one of the great things when you look at maps is to look at maps from a different perspective.
Wonderful example, Claire. I wanted to actually quote just that map because it's such a fun, lighthearted, quirky approach to look at the world from a different perspective. We've all seen upside down maps where you know that are facing south rather than north, and you need to orient yourself at first, or if you see a different projection, you need to quickly orient yourself and so on. But the dolphin map is it's just a joke. How would a dolphin cartographer draw a world map? And so, of course, they are concerned about the bathymetry, or however you pronounce this in English, of the ocean. So that's in there. But they look at the world from upside down because they're in the water looking up. So you have to flip it, and it's mirrored as well. So it's a very confusing visual when you open the page. And then, you know, describing the steps that the dolphin would go through to create this map. It's done by a lovely Dutch fella. It's just a delightful quirkiness to be dealing with, and to really challenge your own perspective. And you've seen this, you probably have done this by mistake. If you open up Google Maps and you played around with it and you accidentally moved it around and you look at the neck of the woods that you actually know really well, but from a different angle, you do get confused for a bit. You do need to orient yourself again, and that's what this is for. Just looking at just turning a globe to the, you know, what we call the water hemisphere, where you just see the most water. That's where Point Nemo is, the most remote point in the ocean where they shoot the spacecrafts, the unused spacecrafts or the Mir satellite space station into that corner of the globe. It's good to actually think about this from a different angle. A Pacific-centered world map has always been, or first came to my attention when I looked at earthquakes. All the earthquakes, of course, happen around the Ring of Fire, the Pacific Rim. And that's just, you don't look at this. Or I don't look at the world this way. And Simon Winchester wrote a wonderful book about the Pacific, also wrote a wonderful book about the Atlantic. But it's just the idea of actually viewing the Pacific at the center of the world then allows you to draw the connection between Japan and the American West Coast, which, if you look at the stock standard world map, is very far from each other, and so you don't think about them. But of course, there is a direct link, and of course, there is a certain Pacificness to all the places that share access to the Pacific, which is, with the stock standard maps that we look at that are centered somewhere around Europe, a bit, yeah, you forget about this.
No, absolutely. And we all have that biases, don't we, of wherever we are in the world, that for a very understandable reason, is the way that we then see the world, because that is our center, you know. And whether it's kind of a political bias or geographic bias, you know, we all kind of have that. I remember the first time that I went and saw the Pacific Ocean, you know, I did kind of like gasp, because it's the other side of the world from where I'm born. But of course, it is a center for people who were born there, you know. So, you know, aesthetically for me, this was, you know, let there be dragons. This was the edge of the world, because I'm from Europe. But and it also raises an interesting point when we talk about maps, and you talked about China and your book not being able to be published there, because Google Maps now, dependent on where you access that map, has different borders for countries. You know, so if you're going to open Google Maps in China, the South China Sea will have, was it the 9-dash line? Because they claim that as theirs, where if you open it up in the Philippines, it doesn't exist, you know, and borders and boundaries can't kind of actually change. So it's actually kind of fascinating that the world of mapping is so geopolitically fraught. And that comes all the way down to where your book can actually be published. You know, it's fascinating.
Very much so. One of the most common things that I get called out on or get angry tweets sent to is always, is Crimea on a map shown as Ukrainian or as Russian? And, you know, what do you do with an annexed thing, with an annexed locale? So, and I'm, of course, not creating those maps, but whoever needs to pick a data set. Usually you just pick big data sets, and then you color them in automatically with your GIS software. And what do you do? Do you look at every contested neck of a corner of the globe, specifically if this is not about this corner? You know, if you just show, I don't know, just do you drive on the left side or the right-hand side of the road kind of map, yeah? And then you color the countries accordingly. And are you then being called out for these kind of things?
You know, I've got a solution for the Crimea thing. Just go back and have a map which is published in about 1750. Then it's part of the Ottoman realm. It's Turkish. Then no one can argue. No one can argue. Now, and on that point, what we should do is have a little bit of quiz action.
Well, let's just let Nick ask his question first.
Sorry. Nick, now's your time, sir.
No, I was just going to say something. Some of the maps you publish are really interesting, but I just wondered the data behind some of them. Do you check that, or do you know where the data comes from that produces those maps?
So what I do a quick check about the maps, and if the map is mostly meant to be funny, I'm not all that fussed. I'm like, there are lots of like simple little jokes. If it's quirky, and some of the data are impossible to really check. You know, do you take your street shoes off, or do you leave them on when you enter a house across the world? What's the most common thing? Of course, this is technically impossible to show, but I think this is just a cute way of sharing this. I'm not checking these kind of things. When I'm sharing something like a map about global GDP, for example, I'm looking that the source is at least mentioned. I'm not going back for every map and, you know, then pull the raw data and see whether that's the actual right GDP measure that they selected. But so I try to make sure that it comes from that the source, data source is correct, but quite often the source that I link to would be Reddit these days, because this is where lots of the amateur cartographers go and publish their stuff. They don't have websites, they don't have blogs or anything. They just put it on the map enthusiast segments of Reddit, and then people enjoy it, or they get yelled at for using a bad color scheme, either one.
And that links to a question I wanted to ask, which was around, obviously you're posting a lot of maps all the time, and you must have kind of favorite sources, and the book's an opportunity, I guess, to give them a bit of profile, I suppose. Were there kind of amateur or kind of regular kind of social media mappers that you wanted to particularly give a bit of platform to?
Part of how this actually worked is that I looked at who are my favorite cartographers, and then I realized some of them actually only post infographics, and I never really was aware of that. But Neil RK does wonderful stuff that I really appreciate. And so you just have, I have a list full of people that I follow, and I have specific lists on Twitter where I have different types of people sorted. And so I scan these lists for content, every yeah. second day or so when I prepare my tweets. And by now, this is also quite a team effort. People sent me tips. Sometimes I know them, sometimes I don't know them. Sometimes the really bizarre, weird stuff is just being sent to me. And on the rare occasion where I don't post a source, then it's usually a meme kind of map that somebody sends me, and I can't, I do a reverse Google image search and I can't find anything, but I share it because it's a cheap laugh. And I've been raised on the mantra that it's better to lose a good friend than to waste a bad joke. So that's, I try to stay true to the family motto.
Right. No, we absolutely need to do the quiz.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Right now, these questions have been drawn together by the wondrous Claire, and they all pertain to your book, sir. So obviously, you are going to get all of these correct, Mr. Kirsten Macker.
This is what I'm thinking. I'm like, I'll definitely lose this one.
You've got the book right there.
This is the honesty principle.
I like that. Right, question number one. Literal meanings of country names. Which European country name literally translates as land of men? Literal meanings of country names. Which European country's name literally means land of men? Is it A, Poland, B, Serbia, or C, Spain, España? Question number two.
Do we write this down? This is me.
Oh yes, yes. Sorry. Yes. Paper and pen out. Sorry. All right. Now, question number two. Literal meanings of country names again. Which European country's name literally translates as Eastern Realm? If you're a German speaker, you can probably work this one out, right? It's is it A, Ukraine, B, Greece, or C, Austria? Which European country's name literally translates as Eastern Realm? Is it A, Ukraine, B, Greece, or C, Austria? Question number three, venomous species. Which country has the most reported venomous species? Is it A, Mexico, B, Brazil, C, Australia? Which country has the most reported venomous species? Is it Mexico, where the Grand Prix is happening this weekend? Is it B, Brazil? Or is it C, Australia, the adopted home of one Simon Kirsten Macker? Question number four, the Antipodes world map. Which of these pairs of countries has territory immediately opposite on the globe? This is hard. Right, Claire. Because all of these sounded quite plausible.
Well, I did have a globe to try and make it sound vaguely plausible, because like no one was going to believe, you know, I don't know, Belgium and Spain.
Yeah. Right. Is it A, Australia and China? B, is it Hawaii and Kenya? Or is it C, Nicaragua and Sri Lanka? Right. So, folks, this is the Antipodean world map. Which of these pairs of countries has territory immediately opposite on the globe? Argentina and China, Hawaii and Kenya, or is it C, Nicaragua and Sri Lanka? Question number five, language difficulty. Now, I'm somebody who infamously cannot learn any foreign languages. I've tried French, terrible. German, forget about it. Italian, pathetic, right? So I think all languages are difficult. But according to the US Government Foreign Service Institute, there are some languages which are harder to learn than others. Now, which is the hardest of these European languages for diplomats to learn? Is it A, Russian, B, Turkish, or C, Finnish? According to the US Government Foreign Service Institute, which is the hardest of these European languages for diplomats to learn? A, Russian, B, Turkish, C, Finnish. French kissing. When greeting people in France, which of the following locations would involve the most number of kisses? A, Lyon.
This is a great map.
A, Lyon, which is a beautiful city, actually. B, Montpellier, or C, Nantes. So which location in France you get the most kisses? Is it in Lyon, B, Montpellier, or C, Nantes? Involvement in the Korean War. This is an excellent, excellent question. Which side did India support in the Korean War? Was it A, North Korea, B, South Korea, or C, both? Involvement in the Korean War. Question number seven. Which side did India support in the Korean War? Did India go for North Korea, supporting the communists? Was it B, South Korea, the capitalists and the Americans, or C, did they hedge their bets and go for both? Last question. The last executions in Europe. When was the guillotine last used to chop someone's head off for being bad? Did it happen in France? Did it happen in France? Did it happen in Switzerland? Or C, did it happen in Sweden? So, when was the guillotine last used for an execution in Europe? Did it happen in France? Was it Switzerland? Or was it in Sweden? There you go, folks. There is your quiz questions. Now, Claire, we need to do some bits and bobs, right? So we build up tension. Sure. There's a slow drum roll happening where people go, oh my goodness, what are the answers to these fiendish questions? So, Claire, do you think?
Okay, so do a quick social media roundup, because I'm doing two today, so I'm going to split it out. And on Twitter, and again, content warning, because we're a family show, but this is not an especially family show friendly element, had a great map posted to Twitter through Magic at Mungo's with retweeting Twitterelectology, which is another one of these maps, which is around language and linguistics. And it's a map showing the prevalence of the use of the phrase fuck off to mean big, as in a fuck off big car. So anyway, what was interesting was this map didn't just show the use of that phrase, but the way that it was framed within the sentence. So in a bit like when we have descriptive adjectives and there's an order for those, at what point in the descriptive adjectives did the phrase come? So I totally recommend that. See that on Twitter on the hashtag Map Corner. So that's quite fun. And there's a few things there on the Twitter hashtag Map Corner. And on the Facebook page, the one I really wanted to mention was the big discussion that happened across the Facebook group around national animals. Where we sort of posted a map around the national animals. We had a big discussion about what the national animals should be, where they are animals which don't really appear in the nation to which has adopted them as their national animal. And that was quite a lot of fun to see the chat. The other thing is Ken McDonald, a friend of the show, regular attendee, posted a map that was a crowdsourced map where people had people had seen rats in Paris. Again, an animal theme there. So that's about sort of naming and shaming where people have seen rats. But I mean, there's all these things about, you know, you're only so many meters from a rat in London, isn't there? So I'm sure that's true for other major cities as well. But yeah, if you don't want to know where all the rats are being seen in Paris, there's a map for that, because, you know, there's a map for everything. So there's a couple of things from the Facebook
page. Wait a minute, wasn't Ratatouille, the movie Ratatouille, wasn't that set in Paris?
It was set in Paris. So, you know, like maybe there are rats in the kitchens as well.
Hey, what are you going to do? There's a rat in the kitchen.
I knew you'd do that.
Rats can get to quite a size. I was wandering down Valencia Street in San Francisco, minding my own business, and this rat, it was the size of a cat. I couldn't believe it. Broad daylight, just decided to go out and have a stroll. I was pretty petrified. They can be pretty big, and those tails are long. Just saying. Anyway, moving on. What else you got to give us, Claire?
Or do you want my map fact of the episode?
Yes, please. I love this bit of the show. Go on.
Okay, so obviously, while we're recording, COP26 is going on. So there's been quite a lot of map content recently around the impacts of climate change. And in fact, there is some good stuff in the book, Simon's book as well, around that. But one that spoke to me particularly was there's a Climate Central have issued a map of coastal risks. So you can see where all the places I was looking in the UK, which are a metre or less from sea level, whatever we mean by sea level these days. Here we're in Bedford, where I live. It's about as far from the seaside as you can get in the UK. It would take 2.5 hours to get to a beach from Bedford, and that's about as far as you'll be anywhere in the UK from the edge of the country. But I noticed that with a meter's worth of sea level rise, I'd be well less than an hour from the edge of the world, because most of Cambridgeshire and Lincolnshire would be underwater. And so that puts me much closer to a beach in those circumstances, although I'm obviously not condoning the inundation of large swathes of the eastern side of the UK. So, you know, puts me closer to the coast, but would be a very bad thing for, you know, quite important areas of the country. And, of course, a very interesting ecosystem around the Fens, which was originally reclaimed from the sea.
Well, exactly. It's the reason why it's so flat. Also, you said, important bits of the country. Is the Fens really that important? Lincolnshire, you know, Norfolk. Can't we even do without them, really? Come on now. Not that important. Right, quiz question time. Right now, Nick Rowworth, you're probably like flexing your brain. They go, I've got this. Though my money's on Brett this month. I think Brett's going to ace this, aren't you, Brett? Right, and of course, Sarah Spilsbury's always a dark horse when it comes to the quiz. Right now, question number, literal meanings of country names. Which European country's name literally translates of the land of men? And Mr. Kirsten Macker, the answer is?
I'm hoping Poland. I'm pretty sure it's not Spain.
Oh, dear.
Oh, dear. And so Claire? It begins.
It is, according to your map, Simon, it's Serbia.
Hmm.
I'm sure that's right.
People of the fields is Poland. The land of many rabbits is Spain.
I did know Spain. All right. Question number two. Literal meanings of country names again. Which European country's name literally translates as Eastern Realm? Now, Mr. Kirsten Mack, if you get this one wrong.
So I have Austria.
Yep, you're correct.
You Austria. Are. Yeah.
Eastern Realm.
Yeah. Österreich, yes. Number three, venomous species. Which country has the most reported venomous species? I got this one wrong, Claire. Mr. Kirsten Macker?
It's not Australia. Pretty sure it's Brazil.
But everyone thinks it's Australia because, you know, it's famously where almost everything can kill you.
Yeah.
But it is, in fact, Mexico.
Oh! So I got this one wrong.
Close-ish to Brazil.
We're on the Antipodes world map. Which of these pairs of countries has territory immediately opposite on the globe? Fiendish this one, Claire. Fiendish. Well done. Argentina and China. Hawaii and Kenya. Nicaragua and Sri Lanka. And Mr. K.
I'm very sure that Chile and China is a pair. So I figured Argentina and Chile, what's the difference? So I figured Argentina and China must be right.
You are correct.
Boom. Well done. Question number five, language difficulty. According to the US Government Foreign Service Institute, which is the hardest of these European languages for diplomats to learn? Is it A, Russian, B, Turkish, C, Finnish? I think I know the answer to this.
I think Finnish, but I got myself confused and now I'm doubting, and I think it might be Russian because they have the additional alphabet challenge in there. So I'm, once again, I have no idea.
I think it's Finnish. Finnish, isn't it? Yeah.
Finnish, so that first one was cut.
Right. And what I like about this map actually is that they have a color coding. I can see this. What have I done? I've turned my camera off for some reason. Just at the prime moment. So they have this color coding, which it sort of has different sort of time spans. But once you get above 44 weeks, it says no specific learning duration, but longer than 44 weeks, which is a sort of like potentially, ongoing, never-ending language learning period of time. But the idea is that you can probably get Russian within 44 weeks, which is, I think, quite a challenge, to be fair, but I suppose if you really put an effort in. And I think also Hungarian, because Hungarian's got a very unusual language base, isn't it?
So. Oh, well, and it's related to Finnish, so it makes sense that it'd be difficult. Yeah. And I've been trying to learn Italian for 25 years, French kissing.
You should be able to do it in 24 weeks, according to this. If you really put your mind to it, Royfield.
Don't have the brain for foreign languages at all. When greeting people in France, which of the following locations would involve the most number of kisses? Lyon, Montpellier, Nantes. And the answer is, Mr. K?
But at this stage, I'm just guessing. Is it Lyon?
It's Nantes.
Again, don't listen to me for anything.
Who collated the data for your book, sir? Because it obviously wasn't you, Mr. K.
So none of the maps are my maps. So this is all just a selection of the, this is Bill Rankin's map that has been on the internet for a long, long time. It's just a quirky, bizarre way of somebody who collected this data. And he shows it as a nice dotty kind of a style, so it's rather wonderful as a visual, but I don't remember things.
And I like the fact that this is a dot map actually, because it just shows you that even in the same location, it might be two, it might be three, it might be three, it might be four. The upshot you'll get from this map is wherever you go in France, you'll never be entirely sure how many kisses you're supposed to do. Because it varies literally all over the place.
Just keep on going.
So is it actually as many as four?
As many as five.
Oh, wow. Crumbs. Right. Moving on. Involvement in the Korean War. Which side did India support in the Korean War? Was it North Korea, South Korea, or was it both? Do they hedge their bets? Mr. K?
No idea. I really want to say both. I think it's such a good answer to have.
It's a fantastic answer.
Here we go. It is both. They sent medical aid to South Korea and other aid to North Korea. So there was most other people picked a side, but India was the one that effectively did both.
Yeah. Just wanted both teams to have fun. Kind of approach.
Where was the guillotine last used for an execution in Europe? A, France, B, Switzerland, C, Sweden. And the answer is, Mr. K?
I want to say definitely not France. So I just picked Switzerland because what do I know? I forgot about it.
Okay, so this is going to surprise people. they've all used the guillotine for executions. And the last one in Sweden was 1910, and the last one in Switzerland was 1940, and the last one in France was 1977.
Wowza. Wowza.
That's really quite recent.
Yeah, it is extremely recent. And it's kind of interesting, when the guillotine was brought in, it was seen as a humane way of killing people, you know, because it's quick and efficient and fast, as opposed to hanging people, where lots of hangings went wrong, didn't they? People, they're like still alive for about 10 minutes, like kicking and screaming, whereas this was seen as a humane way of getting rid of people.
I learned that recently at a podcast of Mike Duncan's, where he plugged your interview with him as well. So I recently thought about you when I heard the term guillotine anyways.
I don't know how to take that, but thank you.
It's an interesting compliment.
Right, folks. So you had some total of 8 answers to give. Anybody get all 8? Feel free to unmute. Stop shaking your head there, Brett. Right. 7. Okay. Right. Now, bated breath. Did anybody get 6 correct? Wow, Claire, these were fiendish.
Oh, yeah. It's a lot easier with a book in front of you. I'll give you that.
How about 5?
Sarah Spilsbury.
Whoa. Go Sandwell. Go Smethwick. How you doing? How you doing? Which ones did you get wrong, Sarah?
I think number 3, that was one about the deadly creatures, wasn't it? What was 6?
Difficult languages. No, yes. No, French kissing.
Yeah, that one I got wrong. And the final one about the guillotine.
Gotcha. Well, I must admit, I would have got. Though I actually knew that the guillotine was still used in France until the 70s. I would have said Switzerland. I just thought it's so obviously cannot be France. It's one of those trick ones.
I'm shocked it was still used. And as you say, it's so recent.
Yeah.
But this raises the question, has it been one of the original guillotines? Or when was the last guillotine produced? Who built the last guillotine of France?
Yeah, what's the working life of a guillotine? I don't know.
Wow. I tell you, right, there was an experiment done in about the 1910s, early 1900s, to see when somebody was guillotined, how long were they still actually conscious? And it was over a minute. And they did it by the doctor kept on calling the name of the person who's guillotined. And up to a minute after his head was severed from his body, he opened his eyes. Obviously, he couldn't speak, but he reacted. It's utterly fascinating.
Guillotine. Oh, that's creepy.
Yeah.
You wouldn't get this experiment through ethics these days.
No. Well, what's the control group? How many people do you need? But over a minute. Can you imagine?
Well, these days they'd put like some sort of electrode things on your head to monitor your brain activity, surely, right?
Yes. As experiments go, this is pretty crude, right? Everything about it was pretty crude, but it was over a minute and he called out and his eyes would close and they called out the guy's name and his eyes opened again. Anyway. Right, Claire. Oof, what a morbid way to end.
That's a chilling way to close it after that.
So, Sarah, I think you know the drill.
I do. So,
I don't know if you're going to do Smethwick again, or we're gonna, you know, cast your net wider afield, but you've got a month to think about it. All right, that's the good news.
All right. Can we have the coffin works in the jewelry quarter?
Possibly.
Oh yeah, that'd be good. Right, so Claire, is it time for us to fold up our maps?
It is time for us to fold up our maps. So yeah, definitely. I want to thank Simon for joining us again, our most popular and returning guest. It's always a pleasure to have you with us on Map Corner. And do you want to give a quick plug for your book?
Well, the latest update that I heard about my book is that it's still stuck in one of those container ships on the ocean. Once again, I'm part of breaking news stories here. So if this book ever makes it to your local bookshops, please buy it and give it to all of your friends. and then ask them Claire's questions. Just take those questions. I, as the author of the book, got 4 out of 8. So I don't think they were on the easy side today, Claire.
Fair enough.
There you go, folks. And another amazing episode of Map Corner. As is apropos for the subject matter, our guest was in Australia. We've had people from all over the globe contribute to this podcast today. So that's me folding up my map. See you all again in approximately 30 days for another rip-roaring barnstorming episode of Map Corner, where we do justice to this most visual of mediums by talking about it on a podcast. Toodle pip, tarara bit. Are you going to say goodbye, Claire?
Goodbye, I'm folding up my map.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.